All right, so let me put it this way. What purpose is there to hunt or trap any cat? Mountain lion, bobcat, feral cat. What is the purpose of doing that other than having a trophy?
Well, the main thing is that it plays into the North American model of wildlife conservation and responsible wildlife management. It also provides a opportunity for sportsmen and women to participate in that management process, to where it's not just left up to Big Brother and some sort of government agency to take care of the management of any species.
You know, and thank you. This is Dan Gates. We thank you for joining us, Dan. Deer Talk Now is on the air. I knew how you were going to go with that because I know that you're a trapper. I know that you're a hunter. You've been an outdoorsman your whole life. And you get it. You understand the North American wildlife model. Unfortunately, across the country, so many people do not. And you're from Colorado. I know you guys are dealing with this now. And the reason why I chummed the waters with that question to start this podcast is that you guys are under attack, aren't you?
We're under extreme attack. We have been for quite some time. And while we put some of those demons to bed for a little while, things have resurfaced since about 2018 significantly. And yeah, we're under big assault. We've got multiple things happening here in Colorado coming up this ballot year in November. And we've got legislative issues that we're dealing with and commission level, wildlife commission levels that we're dealing with. And yeah, we're under attack from all fronts at this point in time.
So if you guys aren't familiar with this, this affects all of us. I mean, we're all about deer, but Colorado is at the forefront of what is going to happen across the country. I'm just going to give a little bit of a introduction. If you don't know Dan Gates, he is so involved with this state, and he has been since, I don't know, Dan, 1976. It's been a long time. Basically, he's been a volunteer for the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Division for more than 40 years, or close to 40 years, a dozen different boards. And if you guys don't know how Colorado works, they have 3,600 volunteers that put in 300,000 hours of service every year, basically saving that state 142 full-time employees that would basically cost the state $9 million. I don't know any other state that does it that way. I think it's a blessing and a curse because now what kind of how you mentioned that is it looks like a lot of ballot box biology that's happening in Colorado.
Yeah, we've got a tremendous amount of influx of ideologies that are brought to the table that their way is better and that our way should be the highway. And the current landscape that we're dealing in is something to where it's been an ongoing agenda from a variety of different sectors. You know, the demographics of Colorado have changed significantly over the last 20 years. And if you go back 35 years or so, we had ballot initiatives back in the mid-90s where there was the banning of spring bear hunting with hounds and baiting. And so we have a fall stalk and spot bear season. And then in 1996, there was a constitutional amendment that actually banned essentially the avocational or recreational trapping side of things with foothold traps, body gripping devices, and cable restraint devices. So all we can use for recreation trapping is cage traps. Now, we can use some of those other tools with exemption permits on private property only for human-animal conflict resolution. But essentially, the recreational side, the avocational side was taken away. The spring bear hunting was taken away. Most recently in 2020, we had a ballot initiative to reintroduce wolves that was up to public opinion, which was successful. And they just dropped 10 wolves on the ground in December. And while we have fought many, many levels through my organizations that I serve and represent and been successful in defeating these measures multiple times through the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission and the Colorado General Assembly, you know, the state legislature, now the opposition has decided to go back to the ballot and give the voters of Colorado an opportunity to change a variety of different things. And we can get into some of that. But the biggest one that we're dealing with is the mountain lion and bobcat hunting ban. And then another one that is up is also a fur ban in the city of Denver and a slaughterhouse ban in the city of Denver that would actually take away one particular one of the largest slaughterhouses in the country, and it's a lamb slaughterhouse. But all three of those intersect. You know, one is food, one is what they don't want you to eat something, they don't want you to wear something, they don't want you to harvest something, they don't want you to do anything with any of it. But it's three different ballot initiatives that we're dealing with this year, and that doesn't include the legislative side of things with wildlife issues and firearms issues and management issues. There's a ton of stuff on the plate, and most people go, "What the hell is happening in Colorado?" And we're still trying to figure some of that out ourselves after the last, 30, 35 years as well.
This is absolutely crazy. I did not know about the foothold traps and body hold trap. Basically, and I don't mean to make light of anybody who lives in Colorado. I have friends who live in Colorado, but it's almost like California. It's basically, if you look at California, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but I believe they banned mountain lion hunting in 72. And I believe they banned, was it any feline hunting in 1990 for
They
bobcats?
actually, bobcats were not that long ago in California. There was guys that were cage trapping bobcats in California. They took foothold traps away there years ago. But the cage traps were still a tool that could be used in the toolbox. But that wasn't too long ago. I think that was less than a decade ago that they actually banned that, as far as cage traps. But yeah, you're right. I mean, we have become Californicated in some people's minds. And it's becoming worse and worse. The problem is that people don't realize it's not the entire state. It's a segment of the
Right.
population that some feel this way, and others have kind of been duped into feeling this way because they're told the lies and the fallacies and the falsehoods of our opposition. And once people become a little bit more educated about the subject matter, more often than not, they're like, "Well, why would we do that?" As opposed to just checking a box somewhere. And that's why we were so successful and have been historically at the Parks and Wildlife Commission and at the legislature, because while we were told we were going to lose on all those levels, once you educate those individuals that are making the decisions and you give them the facts and the data and the science, that Parks and Wildlife is not typically allowed to give, because they can't take a position, and even a level of neutrality is a position according to their stances. So they can't say something positive or something negative or something neutral. They just don't have a position, is what they say. So it's up to us, as sportsmen and women, the conservation groups, the hook and bullet crowd, to actually get the facts that our Parks and Wildlife Division has and present that, because the agency has not been allowed to do so because of gubernatorial wishes, wants, and desires.
We're seeing this across the country. We see it every day here with chronic wasting disease, quote unquote management. I'm not a denier on that. We're not going to go down that rabbit hole, but there's very big similarities here. Dan, as there's so many different committees. You serve on the Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. I know you have your own business, Colorado Rid-A-Critter. Basically, you're doing abatement for landowners and things like that, like if they've got problem animals.
Well, we do a lot of that, but we do a lot of habitat restoration and consulting. When I first started this business 37 years ago, and my son runs it with me now, and he's 32, we did a lot of skunks and squirrels and raccoons and, general pest control type stuff. But then it came into something about 1996 into the early 2000s, once Amendment 14 passed. A lot of those tools that I mentioned were taken off of the landscape. You couldn't use them except for specific circumstances. But then our population growth was so significant in Colorado. We went from 2.9 million people to roughly 5.9 million people now. And the government agencies that were providing some sort of solution or human-animal conflict resolution solutions, their staff and their resources weren't available to keep up with the need from the general population that was moving into animal habitat. And so our business started to expand, as did others. But then ours got into a level to where, we're doing power plants and we're doing Department of Defense contracts and utility service companies and water treatment facilities and open space properties and agriculture and residential and industrial properties as well. We do school districts and we do bus depots and we do some dam work. And it morphed into so much more. We're licensed pesticide applicators. We go through our regular continuing education credit program. We do things that most people say, oh, I don't want to do that. Because the guy that traps squirrels on the ground or gets on a 12-foot ladder doesn't want to get into a 125-foot boom lift that cost him $6,500 a week. Our dumbasses will do that. And so our wildlife control has morphed into a human animal conflict resolution business. So it gives me a little bit of different perspective, I believe, when they're starting to deal with the wildlife management side of things that I've been involved in for so long. Not that I know what everybody feels, but I damn sure know what a lot of people feel when they call us to come solve the problem, when we are in their house, in their attic, and in their business and on their property. Everybody has a breaking point, a tolerance level of when it comes to, I want to live with wildlife until,
Right.
and that's where we're at on a lot of different levels is in Colorado. We are dealing with a lot of the until crowd that, yes, I want wolves until, I want mountain lions until it affects me. And now things are starting to affect either the people or their neighbors or their businesses or the open space that they like to recreate on. And I think that they're starting to see that government overreach and animal extremism is not in the best interest of wildlife management.
It's not. I mean, we learned that from Aldo Leopold. Some people have glossed over it and put, I mean, Aldo Leopold, obviously the father of modern conservation management, but they've glossed over the whole fierce green fire, making that a warm, fuzzy feeling when he was a wolf trapper to begin with. He realized there had to be a balance. But what I want to go through here, and to the point you made until, so we're talking, we started this talk about mountain lions and bobcats. Bobcat's not a huge, we're talking about deer. Obviously, I always want to bring it back there. It's deer talk. But bobcat's not a huge predator on deer. Well, why do you care about them then? Because it's about a balance. It's about turkeys and other things too. Mountain lions. But let's go through your list here. I'll start with your big one. Well, big to me. Mule deer population has plummeted from about 600,000 40 years ago to about 370,000 today. Elk has gone, the world's largest elk population in Colorado, calving rates are what, a third of what they used to be. And now we're talking about you can't kill mountain lions, you can't kill bobcats, we're forcing wolves on you. What is that going to do to Colorado's rich history of deer and elk? I know you don't have a lot of whitetails, you have some. That balance is going
More.
to be really thrown out of whack, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that you listen to people that talk about returning the balance back to nature. You talk about rewilding and this utopia mentality that people want to throw on the landscape of, well, in Yellowstone or in Glacier or in Yosemite or in Denali or whatever. And I'm like, if you haven't noticed, I haven't seen any skyscrapers and 8-lane highways going through Yellowstone. Yellowstone doesn't have grazing of cattle. Yellowstone doesn't have the public land component of what we do on national forest. National parks are different than national forests. The recreation component in Yellowstone, while it's there, I mean, you can't take your motorbike and your mountain bikes and run all over Yellowstone wherever the hell you want to go, just like what you can on National Forest or Bureau of Land Management. You can't go camp just wherever you want and then do what you want to in a national park and as what you can on National Forest or Bureau of Land Management property. So when you start talking about the influx of predators, unmanaged predators in populations, there's no control measures. There's no effort to be able to balance what we've already screwed up as people on the planet. You want to rewild stuff? I guess we get rid of the people if you really want to go back to
It's
rewilding,
true.
because that's and I said that in a meeting before, and you hear gasp in the back. Oh, he's trying to extirpate the human population. No, I'm making a joke about the fact that you want to rewild something when you got 6 million people in a state that has 84 million visitors a year. We got 6 million people, more people than Colorado, Idaho, and Wyoming combined. We have 84 million visitors compared to 33 million visitors in those other three states. There's only a certain amount of human-animal interactions that you can have and expect that those animals to continue to propagate to some level of security for sustainable wildlife management in perpetuity. And look, I'm a human being. We have animal beings. We're all on the landscape. We are supposed to be the stewards. We're not supposed to just sit back and watch things happen. And I don't care whether you're a religious person or whether you're not. The fact of the matter is, we've screwed the planet up enough that if I want to turn around and engage in some sort of outdoor recreational opportunity to watch wildlife, to pursue wildlife, or maybe harvest wildlife, that should be part of the equation for us to be able to manage wildlife in some capacity where it's all of the people. You look at the North American model, there's a public trust doctrine component of the model. It's my public, your public, it's the anti's public. That's the wildlife that is there. We are all part of the public. And I think that that stuff needs to be managed appropriately. And when you start talking about bobcats and mountain lions, there's a component there that people just disregard that that has any play into a component of my being on the landscape and me being able to pursue that and game agencies being able to manage that in perpetuity. And in Colorado's case, for 961 species of wildlife and 5.9 million people with 84 million visitors, it has to have some balance. I'm not saying no sportsman in the world wants to get rid of everything.
Exactly.
If we did, we wouldn't have anything to turn around and be able to pursue and chase and try to harvest. I want it just as much as the next person. I just want to be able to utilize it, and I want to be able to utilize it in a sustainable fashion and make sure it's humane and make sure it's ethical, make sure it's moral, and make sure it's highly regulated to where we have those populations past myself, past my son, past his son, and past his son. I want to make sure that that happens. And that's going to become less and less likely when Colorado grows from 5.9 to 7.9 to 9.9 to 13 million people. It's the sportsmen and women that are going to provide that resource ability to be able to continue to manage it.
Deer Talk Now is brought to you by 10 Point Crossbow Technologies. Whether I'm in a tree stand, ground blind, or spot and stalk hunting, I know the Nitro 505 is up to any challenge. Check one out at a dealer near you or log on to 10pointcrossbows.com for more information. To your point, Dan, one thing I've said on this podcast before, there is a place for wolves. There's a place for mountain lions. There's a place for everything. But you can't pick and choose, oh, we're going to manage elk, we're going to manage deer, but we're not going to manage these other species. Because why? Because they're pretty, because they're cool, or because, you know, I don't think it's right that you should. There is a place for everything. But I want to go through each one of your specific species here. Just get your take. Let's start with elk. What is the situation with elk in Colorado? Is it in peril? I listed those numbers. I mean, the population is not what it used to be, and now what does it look like in the future with the current state of affairs?
Well, look, we've still got the largest elk population in the world, and that being said, habitat degradation and erosion and loss is a contributing factor to elk calf cow recruitment and retention of the herds. And I want to stress, I'm not a biologist. I've just been around this all my life, and I've learned a lot, and I read a lot, and I'm involved a lot, and I'm integrated myself into the concept of all these things. So I don't want anybody to think, well, he might talk like a biologist or he thinks he's a biologist. I'm not.
No.
But I work on many boards and committees to make sure that we are doing what the best possible management objectives we can from a stakeholder position. We've got the largest elk population in the world, but we have significant human population, and we have an infrastructure that has created hurdles and barriers for numerous wildlife species. You look at the things that we're trying to do with building overpasses and underpasses on our roads, but to do that, you have to fence the entire highway. And for people back east that don't understand this and haven't seen it, you might fence 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 miles of highway on both sides with 10-foot fence to keep the animals from crossing and getting onto the highways. But you're altering their migratory patterns. You're altering the habitat side of things. You're altering public land and private land use, and you're saving wildlife in the process, but you're changing and making those animals adapt to your direction. I say this tongue in cheek, but it's no less than a large stock pen that you're taking them in, and you're forcing them to go to a specific direction to get to another location. We've done that with our wildlife because we have migratory herds in Colorado. They've got migratory herds in Wyoming and other Western states. They don't have that necessarily in
Right.
Ohio
It's
or
very
like
unique.
Iowa or
Yep.
Missouri. And so we've altered the landscape to help the wildlife, but to also help the people. Okay, so to do that, why can't those same people that advocate for that practice advocate for also adapting our practices to the wildlife for management purposes on other levels? So the people that advocate for high fences and overpasses and underpasses, which I'm one of them, but a lot of those people, they don't want us to hunt. They don't want us to pursue wildlife. They don't want us to turn around and use hunting and fishing as the primary funding mechanism and the management tool. But they're willing to let us alter the landscape so we can push wildlife to a specific spot and go up and over and down the hill and through the river and to grandma's house. We have to make sure that we are doing the best for elk as what we are doing for deer and now for wolves and bears and mountain lions and the other 961 species of wildlife that we have in this state, 78 of which are game species that Colorado Parks and Wildlife actually sells licenses for. A lot of those are small game. Some of those are fur bearer. There's about 10 big game species. You know, when you get into elk that can jump 6 foot fences and they typically go in groups of 30 or 40 or 50 or maybe 800, depending on the year and time of year. Just because you see what you see at one particular time doesn't mean that that's spread over the entire state of
Right.
Colorado. They're still specifically geographically oriented because of the type of terrain. They come from the high country, move down to the lower country, typically during the winter. They migrate. What are the wolves going to do? They're not going to stay at the high country.
They're going to
They're going to move
follow him.
down to the low country. What's down in the low country? People, ranch land, pasture land, livestock. The opportunity for human animal conflict is going to increase. If people don't think that that's going to be the same with mountain lions are going to pursue animals where they live. So if they all move down and there's no harvest of mountain lions, no pursuit of mountain lions, no harassment or giving mountain lions a reason to be scared of people, where are they going to go? They're going to go down to the low country, which some of them do anyway, but they're dispersed because we have some hound hunting that puts them back into different locations and forces them to go to another drainage or maybe to another game management unit or something. If we don't do any of that stuff, where have we drawn the line of where we're going to interact for wildlife and stewardship management, or where are we just going to let things go for a free-for-all and we're going to sit back and then complain about what we didn't do 20 years from now or what we could have done? While the population of the human population continues to grow, urban sprawl continues. We put more fences up along the highways and more overpasses and underpasses. I don't know how you guys feel back east, but with our management objectives that we have out here, there's only a certain amount of land that you have to be able to graze specific species. And while I know guys in Iowa that can put 40 cows on an acre for a week, a lot of times you might have to put 40 acres per cow out here.
Right.
And so that's why the livestock is grazed in rotation patterns, and that's why the deer and elk and the big ungulates go in rotation patterns because they eat down some, they go to another area. That's what they've historically done. We've altered those paths so many different ways because of those high fences, which I think is necessary to save wildlife on the highways and to make sure that we have less collisions and so forth. But we've already altered the landscape to the point to where we act like it's a big giant zoo, except for we don't have high fences all around the state perimeter dividing us between other states. I think that we're in a position where we can set the tone and narrative for future management objectives and use and do it very responsibly, very thoughtfully, taking into consideration that people that don't like hunting and people that do like hunting and make sure we bring those together to find commonalities and look at what we're doing 30, 40, 50 years down the road as opposed to what somebody's griping about right now that they think's happening wrong in their backyard.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. We need more Dan Gates across this country. People who are intelligent, who understand, who get it on the overall balance. One thing that popped in my head when you were talking, Dan, about I wasn't aware of the fencing, not the extent of the fencing, wasn't aware of that. And if you think about that for a minute, okay, you're talking about elk, which, like you said, is a species that is going to roam. It's not like a whitetail that. There is some dispersal among whitetails, especially in the upper Great Lakes, northern regions, where they will migrate in winter. That has been changed through man-made means. But when you're making them move, and now you're introducing, we often think of we're pitting one animal against another. But if in areas with wolves, you got hydatid disease, you've got other things that come along that people aren't necessarily thinking about, and then that you cannot play God that way. Like you said, you cannot say, this is my zoo, this is how I'm going to manage it. You got to manage the wildlife for the wildlife's sake, and that goes all the way to the flora, not just the fauna. It's about the species, and I know that overgrazing is huge in Nebraska. It's huge in other places that don't have the diversity of like a woodland, upland, lowland mix and things like that. But I digress. We talked about elk. I know mule deer are in there as well. And some people, if you go back to the lions in particular, some people say, okay, you got 4,000 to 7,000 mountain lions. How much could they possibly affect? Well, if you only got a couple hundred thousand elk and you only got a couple hundred thousand deer, it doesn't take much when you put these apex predators out there, black bears, now wolves. You're going to be looking at a completely different picture if something doesn't happen 20, 30, 50, 75 years from now.
Yeah, and you talk about the elk dispersal. I think it says that bull elk have a home range through GPS collar tracking studies and stuff of like 63,000 acres.
Wow.
A bull elk. A cow elk has somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 to 38,000 acres. A mountain lion's home range could be double that, depending, or triple that, or quadruple. We just had a story that came out that they collared one mountain lion in Utah and it traveled over 1,000 miles. On its GPS collar, they tracked it and it went, different directions and back and forth over 1,000 miles. Show me a whitetail that does that regularly.
We're doing it
Like in
in
a
we're
mile.
doing it in square miles at a
Yeah,
time, not thousands.
I know guys back in Ohio and stuff that this they know that the deer lives on their 40 acres for 250 of the 365 days out of the year. And he might live on the neighbor's 40 acres outside of that. And some go farther. Obviously, I'm not a biologist, but I'm just giving some statistics that what we know here. But somebody has to think and not be selfish. And the conservation-minded sportsmen and women of the United States have not been selfish by self-imposed taxes and laws and rules and regulations. To adhering to what we've created as the North American model. We've not been selfish. We've done that for the general wildlife population as a whole. And each, classification of wildlife has its own sector that is appropriately managed, whether it's the Migratory Bird Act or the Marine Mammal Act, or you look at Dingell Johnson and Pittman Robertson, you got fish and wildlife, and you got the endangered species side of things. And we have done this as sportsmen and women to get it. People say, well, government did. No, government didn't do that. The sportsmen and women went to government officials to do that. It wasn't imposed from government. Big Brother didn't solve conservation efforts. But we don't need animal rights extremists trying to solve conservation efforts either. For one, they don't pay into the damn system. For two, that their deal is zero. Everything is zero. You don't harvest anything and it's fine. Doesn't matter what you have. Doesn't matter how many blades of grass you have in the lawn. We're talking about one animal. No, we're talking about the entire lawn. We're talking about the entire golf course, the entire soccer field. We know that we have sustainable wildlife populations because of the North American model, the principles that are guided under game management agencies, essentially in all 50 states. I want to make sure that we manage things so we can utilize them now and appropriately manage them, with a distinction that 10, 20, 50, 75 years from now, that dumb bastards like me and you can still turn around and say, we've done this for the last 200 years or the 250 years or whatever the mark is at. And I think at that point in time, we're still going to have the extremists go, you're wrong and we're right. And as we continually to propagate our resources, even though the landscape and the habitat continually shrink, our model is still going to be the best model because they have no model except for zero. They don't have a suggestion or a recommendation or alternative or a solution. They say, what you do is wrong. And what I say is right, and you need to fix it. Well, then when you ask them, what should we change? Well, it has to be different. How should we change it? It can't be like this. What should we do? It can't be like that. They don't have suggestions. It's no. It's like telling the kid, don't get into the cookie jar. Why? Because I said so. Well, give me a reason. It's still because I said so. That's what the animal extremists are telling us. It's because I said so. We know better. You guys don't. You need to get off the landscape and let things go back to nature, rewild itself, and you sit there and watch it, you know, degrade and erode. And as long as you're not using it, we're completely satisfied with that.
Spot on. I cannot add to that. Dan, now, so what do you tell the average guy or gal who's an outdoors person, hunter, fisherman, trapper, always add trapper in there? Well, there's nothing I can do about it. What can I do about it?
Well, if we're talking holistically throughout the United States and North America, I encourage people to educate themselves. And I'll talk about Colorado specifically just because of the issues, but to educate themselves. And, you know, the best way to do that is find out who is representing your interest, whether it's at a commission level, a legislative level, or a federal level. And if you don't know who is in those positions, whether you elected them or not, whether you voted or not, then you better get off your ass and you better go vote. If you don't know who they are, you should find out. If you don't know who you checked the box for last year, but you know that you voted, well, then that's part of the problem. It's not part of the solution. It sounds like it's hardline criticism, but it's a fact. People are put into positions of power and influence by people that have the ability to make those decisions to put them into those positions. Now, in our case in Colorado, the people of Colorado voted for a particular individual to run the state. While they might believe that he's doing the best for them, the people that he appoints, the people that he puts into those positions, might not be necessarily in the best interest of those people that thought that they were getting what they didn't get. And so, you know, I do presentations at some of our banquets and conventions and a little bit of public speaking. I'm not the best public speaker in the world by any means, but I got a big mouth and, you know, strong back, broad shoulders and a weak mind. So I can do a bunch of that stuff. But you ask people, who did you vote for? They don't know. Ask them what district that they live in. They don't know. That's not everybody, but it's becoming pretty evident that a lot of us, Democrat, Republican, and Independent, doesn't matter what side of the fence you stand on or if you're in the middle. If you don't know what district you live in, how the hell do you know who you voted for? In Colorado, for instance, I can't speak to every other state, but Colorado has an open Capitol. That means we can go in there and we can talk to the Sergeant of Arms in the House or the Senate, and we can give them a business card and ask to speak to our particular representative or our senator, as long as we know who that is. You can't go in there and say, I don't know where I live and I don't know who I need to talk to. You have to do a little bit of homework before you go. But it's an open door policy to where you can go in there and talk to those individuals. And if they're busy in a committee and they can't step out, you can go to their office and you can set an appointment. They like to hear from their constituents. But when they hear from nobody and then everybody gripes about what decisions they made, whose fault is it? I think it's the voters' fault, and it's damn sure the sportsmen and women's fault if they don't engage in that opportunity. And I think that's the first thing. Educate yourself nationwide or in Canada and become familiar with the topic and the landscape and the discussions that are happening that will benefit you or that will adversely affect you. There's repercussions and ramifications of lack of action. And if something happens and we don't engage, then it's our responsibility to either pick up the flag and engage or to sit back and not gripe about it anymore. And in today's environment, I think we have so many tools or mechanisms available to us through social media that you can get down some rabbit hole and you come out of there all fired up and want to kill somebody because what's going on social media. But if you don't know the process and the procedure of how to engage and how to rectify that, to contact the people that are making the decisions, why do you get back on social media to turn around and listen to all the griping and moaning, groaning, and complaining? No solutions are going to be done on that thing. Activation engagement can. But I'm talking about positivity. I'm not talking about negativity. And I think from a sportsman and women's perspective, I'm talking about proaction, not reaction. And we need to make sure that we set the tone and we set the narrative for what is concerning to us, whether it's turkeys in Pennsylvania or whitetails in Ohio or elk and bighorn sheep in Colorado and Montana, or maybe it's mountain lions in all the western states. It's up to us to make the decisions on what we want our legislators and our commissioners and our federal elected officials to do on our behalf. And if they're not hearing from us, if they don't know who we are, if they don't know what organizations we're part of or represent, how are they going to make the decisions on our behalf? But our behalf is wildlife behalf. It's conservation behalf. It's sustainable scientific wildlife management behalf. If they don't know that, who are they going to hear it from? They keep hearing it from the animal activists, the extremists. What direction are they going to go? They think that that's what's on the landscape, when in all reality, it's probably only about 2 to 4% of the general population. We're not a great big population ourselves, but we fund the system. We do all of the work. We do the yeoman's work. We have fish and game agencies. We don't have animal activist agencies. We have animal activist organizations trying to alter and infiltrate those agencies that we should be propping up as a community, as a whole. That's the first thing. And then the next thing I'd say is make sure that people are helping to fund the fight. Being a participant of a member of an organization is fantastic. We need that because those conservation habitat groups do the yeoman's work. But other groups are doing more fight than they are habitat conservation. And the habitat conservation groups, because of their tax structure, are limited on what fight they can do because of their tax status. So contribute, donate, volunteer time, get educated. That's hard for a lot of sportsmen and women to hear because they want to get a license and they want to go hunting. They want to do their scouting and they want to do their application process. If I joke about this, that if we all as sportsmen and women would give 8 hours a year to the fight, gosh. I'm not talking about banquets. I'm not talking about fundraisers. I'm talking about dealing with the people that are making decisions and going to a rally where those people are influential individuals in the society and let them know your feelings. If we wrote letters, if we testified, if we participated 8 hours a year per person, we would be undeniably the most formidable proponents of what we stand for on the planet.
That's an excellent, excellent statistic and something that everybody should take heed of. It's in our hands. It's our system. Like I said, when you referred to who paid for this, when I say we, I'm talking about the community. We volunteered. Pittman Robinson, we volunteered to give that money. Yes, please tax me on this. Please tax me on this because I want to see this for, and that was what, 1932 something? 37. So it was like way back, my dad was born in 35. So way back then, that's what led us to here today. But I'll leave it there. Dan Gates, thank you so much. This has been incredible insights that you provide. I can tell that you're doing this daily. I love the background, by the way, the elk and all the pictures. It's pretty cool. But coming to us from God's country in Colorado, any website, social media page where our listeners can check you out and learn more about what you're doing out there in Colorado?
Yeah, and I want to say really quick, thanks for having us on. And we've been doing a lot of podcasts, a lot of outreach, social media. If they're interested, anybody's interested, you can go to SaveTheHuntColorado.com. That's SaveTheHuntColorado.com. That's our website. We're also on Instagram at CRWM, and then we've got a Facebook page as well. But you can get on any of that stuff and see just how involved we are in what we're trying to do to save the hunting in Colorado. But what I would like people to do really specifically is if they go and donate, that we're more than happy because we need money to be able to fight the enemy. And we're fighting the enemy not just on behalf of Colorado. It's on behalf of the entire United States. And the reason I say that, we have Initiative 91 that is on the website. And it's a PDF. You can click that. You can read it or you can download it. I urge everybody to do that and look at the language in that text. And it will set the statutory definition. If passed, it will set the statutory definition of what trophy hunting is. And it's not set anywhere in the United States. We would be the first to have that done. If they're successful, the way it reads is intentionally killing, wounding, stalking, pursuing, and entrapping a mountain lion or a bobcat. You could take any animal out of our game species and put in the mountain lion or bobcat. But when they start defining what trophy hunting is, but they're really defining hunting, and you look at the other components, the other bullet points in that measure, they want to get rid of dogs. They want to get rid of hounds. They want to get rid of electronic collars for upland bird dogs and for waterfowl dogs or coon dogs. They don't want you to use a dog, period. They don't want you to use any tools, period. They don't want you to do the harvest. But really pay attention to the language because statutory definition is easily set as a precedent in other states and federally to say this is what it is. And that's how you get into federal court cases. That's how you get into people making decisions on our behalf that we have no control over if we don't engage in the initial process. So look up Initiative 91 on SaveTheHuntColorado.com. If you're so inclined to help us out and fight these measures, keep in mind that if we're successful in defeating them here, it makes it harder for them to come to your state and do the exact same thing. And because we are looking at a statutory definition change that will set a precedent nationwide. So we appreciate all the support. Look forward to working with anybody and just appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation with you guys.
If that doesn't fire you guys up, I don't know what to say. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Deer Talk Now. I want to just remind everybody we're new to Spotify. That's added to our platform list. So go, if you got Spotify, go follow us there or just keep following us wherever you're following Deer Talk Now. For Dan Gates, I am Dan Schmidt. Thank you for joining us, and we'll catch you next Thursday for another episode of Deer Talk Now.